I've mentioned this particular chapter on a couple of times when I spoke on Psalm 23, so I thought that I would do a quick overview of this particular chapter, because it's such an encouraging chapter to read if you understand what Isaiah was saying, not only to the generation to which he spoke and wrote, but to us today in our generation. It's good to remind ourselves of some of the great things that God himself has promised to us. And in many ways, we have to try and capture the vision of the prophet in this particular chapter. We need to, as it were, see through Isaiah's eyes and anticipate what God is saying to us through Isaiah. And it's such an encouraging chapter to read. It's one of those stimulating chapters that time and time again stir us up. It was only when I was going through in my daily readings with Isaiah, in the book of Isaiah, that is, that I came across this chapter, and I thought, oh yeah, this would be a wonderful chapter to deal with, to remind ourselves of the great things that God has got in store for us, and how we're ultimately going to get there. But if you can think for a moment of the Jews themselves in the time of Jesus, when they would have been anticipating such a great time for Israel, they would have been looking out in anticipation of this great king that was promised to come, and they were looking forward to the time when the nation would be elevated and lifted up, and there would be such a magnificent time, greater even than the time of David and of Solomon, his son. And such a magnificent period of time that was going to come upon the Jews. And they anticipated this great kingdom coming and David's greater son appearing on the scene of time and bringing about judgment upon the world on the one hand, and then salvation and redemption on the other for his chosen people. And yet for all of what they said, what we can say is that they misunderstood and misrepresented what the Old Testament was teaching. They didn't fully grasp it. They had a blind spot with regard to the Gentiles. They didn't like the idea of the Gentiles being incorporated into God's people. And so in that sense, they refused to accept Jesus when he came. When they saw Jesus, they, as we know, rejected and refused him, and ultimately put him to death. They refused to accept that he was God's son, or that he was David's great, great, great grandson. You know, way back when this one who was prophesied time and time again, and God was telling them, look, there's one coming, you know, in the line of David, and you should anticipate a time when he would come. And for them, they were expecting this great king to appear. And as I say, they were expecting the defeat and overcoming of the Gentile nations, and the resurrecting, as it were, of the stateliness of Israel itself. But that didn't happen, not as they anticipated. But for you and I, when we read a chapter like this, we are to see past the New Testament era, to see past the time of when the Jews was anticipating the Messiah coming. And we are to look forward in the greater prospect of what God intended them to understand in this particular chapter. It's such a wonderful chapter. It's one of those things that in order for us to be elevated and stimulated, you know, we need to remind ourselves, isn't it, what God has in store for us. You know, when Paul was writing to the church in Colossians, he told them, didn't he, that they were to set their minds and their hearts upon things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. They were to live in anticipation that when Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall we also appear with him in glory. There was this anticipation. And it was always part and parcel of the writings of the Apostle Paul to stimulate and to stir these people up to anticipate such a glorious and wonderful future that lay before them. And I think this is what Isaiah was doing here. He was presenting a wonderful, glorious picture of what they should anticipate, that great things were going to take place. God himself was going to be manifest. The glory of God was going to be revealed. And in this chapter, it is all there for us. In many ways, to understand a chapter like this, we have to see it, as it were, through the prism of the New Testament era and the writings of the apostles and the sayings of Jesus. And we are to see exactly what it was that Isaiah was saying to these people. I think when you look at the chapter, you can split the chapter up in actual fact into verses, like verses 1 and 2. We could say that it's a picture really of paradise regained. Now, you, when you read those two verses, you might think, where do you see that? But anyway, we'll have a look at it and we'll draw it out now in a second. And then verses 3 to 7, there's this place where paradise is assured for us, that we are moving in that direction of moving into paradise itself. And then, of course, paradise and our arrival there in verses 8 to 10. But to look at these particular verses like that, to split up the chapter, because if you remember back what happened at the fall, you know, when Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, they were in this paradise, they were enjoying this status and this condition. They had everything that they required to sustain their life. They had a wonderful relationship with God, that they could speak with Him and they could enter into fellowship with Him. It was such a wonderful time and experience for them. And yet, as we know, the fall came. Satan deceived Eve, and Eve led Adam into sin, and the fall came about, and the ramifications of that were pretty dire, because the ramifications, of course, were that sin entered into the world, death through sin. Creation itself came under a curse from God, that God cursed the land and the ground, and women, instead of having an easy time of childbirth, were going to give birth to children in sorrow. And the sad thing is that man was going to become a wanderer in this world that God had given to him, that he was going to be exiled from Eden and from paradise. They were going to be cast out. They were going to be wandering around like Cain, as it were. And they were going to find themselves in this awful, terrible situation. God, as it were, was a far off from them. They didn't have a relationship with Him. They didn't know God any longer. They couldn't experience His presence. They couldn't commune with God. And yet they were barred from anything that was glorious, that place called Eden, that paradise that God had given to them. And so it was a sad situation to find themselves like that. But here in these particular verses, here in verses 1 and 2, what you see here is a reversal of that situation. You know, the fall of man and creation being cursed, what happened? The anomalies that take place in creation now, isn't it? You know, massive rainfall, great heat, deserts, wilderness, you know, massive flooding, all kinds of things that, you know, should not be taking place in creation. But because of the curse, of course, creation is now flawed. And because it's flawed, we have all these aberrations that take place in creation. But what we see here in these verses is such an encouragement to us. What's going to happen to the wilderness? What we read here in verses 1 and 2, the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord and the majesty of our God. What a tremendous declaration here. It's like a reversal of the situation. These three areas that are mentioned, the cedars of Lebanon, the oaks of Carmel, and the flowers, or the oaks of Sharon, rather, Carmel, and the flowers that blossomed in Sharon. It's such a wonderful picture. For these Jews, they would have understood it straight away. They would have seen a complete reversal of the situation. Water would be flourishing there. The wilderness and the dry land should be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like a crocus. It's as if all of the state of creation is going to be reversed. When you think of the Apostle Paul, when he was writing to the church in Rome, in Romans chapter 8, you know, and he speaks about creation there, doesn't he? And he speaks about the glory that's going to be revealed, you know, the manifestation of the sons of God. And creation at this moment of time, he says, is what? It's living in hope. It's almost as if he personifies this situation. He says, well, creation itself is waiting for the manifestation of the children of God. Why is that? Why is creation waiting at this moment of time? And he says, well, what's going to happen is that creation itself is going to be delivered into the glorious liberty of the children of God. In other words, creation itself is going to be set free from the bondage and the corruption of the curse that God has implemented upon it because of man's sin. There is going to be a reversal of this. Paradise, which was lost, is a paradise that's going to be regained, as John Milton says. It's this situation that is being described for us, the wonder of it. You know, no more anomalies in creation, no more sufferings, no more drought and barrenness, no more floods. You know, there's going to be a perfect harmony that's going to exist in creation. There is going to be a restoration of the world in which we live at this moment of time. And so you and I are going to be part and parcel of that recreation of God. We are going to be in that place where there isn't drought, there isn't devastation. And here is the writer, Isaiah, saying to us, look, consider these things. But over and above all of that, he says, what's going to happen is the restoration of God to be with his people. His glory is going to be made manifest. And his glory is going to be made manifest, he says, in creation itself. Now, we know that the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows forth his handiwork. The glory of God is made manifest in creation at this moment of time. But even in this fallen, corrupt creation in which we see around and about us, something of the glory of God is still impressed upon it. You know, we can be amazed, can't we, at some of the things that we see in creation. We can be amazed at what God has done. But to think of it, that we are in the fallen creation, well, what must it be like? What would it have been like for Adam and Eve in that creation to have surveyed these things and the glory of God uninhibitedly revealed and portrayed in creation? But the new creation, where God's glory is to be revealed, as he says here, they shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. In other words, what Adam and Eve lost in the Garden of Eden, where they lost that fellowship with God and they lost that vision of God and enjoying the company and fellowship of God, suddenly all of this is going to be restored and the glory of God shall be made manifest to them again. What we read in the book of Revelation is that they shall see his face. In other words, his glory shall be made manifest to us in a way in which we find it hard to comprehend at this moment of time. Now we are looking through a glass darkly. Then we shall see him face to face. There will be the glory of God made manifest in a way in which we cannot possibly conceive it at this moment of time. And yet, here is Isaiah saying, look, we should be living in anticipation of this. We should be looking forward to this. This is what should stimulate us. This is what should stir us up to realize what is waiting us in the future. But of course, there may be those who perhaps are fearful that perhaps they won't keep going. They won't get to that destination. Will I arrive in that new creation? Will I fall away? Will I desert the cause of Christ? But here's the writer, Isaiah, he's saying to us, look what God wants to give to us at this moment of time. What he wants to do is he wants to strengthen and to encourage us. There in verses 3-7, what you get is the certainty of our perseverance and our arrival in glory. This is a statement of assurance for the people of God. He's talking to those perhaps who are discouraged, those who are cast down, those who perhaps need to have some stimulus, those who need to be uplifted and encouraged. And he says to them, strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees, those who perhaps are fearful of their situation. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and save you. Behold, your God is coming. Be strong, he says, fear not. Do you remember Joshua when he was going to go into the promised land? These are the same words that God gave to him as he's about to embark on this mission to cross over Jordan, to enter into the promised land, to fight off all the giants that were portrayed as being there. He was to be strong. He was to have confidence in God. He was to trust in what God was going to do. He was to believe in the promises of God and believe in what God had said, that God had promised Abraham and his children that they were going to be the beneficiaries of this land. And here they were, just about to embark, going over the Jordan to pass into the promised land. Here was something that was to encourage them. They were to not be fearful, not allow themselves to be cast down. And the only way which we can do that is by faith, of course, and hope and trust. To have that belief in what God himself has chosen to reveal to us. And the contrast is great, isn't it? What you find is that these particular people were supposed to be moving forward, going forwards. Because what's going to happen, he says, be strong, fear not, behold, your God will come with vengeance and recompense of God. He will come and save you. What's the two aspects that are being revealed here? You say this. On the one hand, isn't it, here is vengeance coming. Behold, your God will come with vengeance and the recompense of God. Then on the other hand, he will come and he will save you. In other words, you have the contrast made, isn't it? Here is judgment and salvation. Here is judgment, retribution. And yet, on the other hand, here is redemption and salvation. Something glorious is going to take place. Often you find these two complementing each other. It's almost like two sides of the same coin. You know, it's looking at both at the same time. And this is what the Jews were anticipating, that when this Messiah was to come, judgment was going to fall upon the nations, and the peoples around and about them who were opposed to them would be destroyed. Salvation would come by way of deliverance. So they were living in anticipation of that. But this is what Isaiah is saying. Look, God is coming. Judgment is going to fall. Vengeance, recompense. But he's going to come, he says, and he's going to save you. Salvation is coming to us. On the one hand, when judgment falls upon the world, salvation is the part for God's people. There is no way in which you and I can be lost. The certainty of our arrival there is guaranteed to us. The assurance is given to us here, isn't it? Look at these verses, in verses 5 to 7. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. For waters break forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert, and burning sand shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water in the haunt of jackals where they lie down. The grass shall become reeds and rushes. Such blessing is going to come. You see, the eyes of the blind, the sightless, the deaf, the lame, the mute, something wonderful is going to happen to them. It's very easy, isn't it, for us to see here the work and ministry of Jesus when you think of the miracles that he performed. You know, the blind see, the deaf hear, the mute speak, the lame walk. These miracles that were performed by Jesus. Do you remember when John the Baptist sent two disciples to see Jesus to ask him, are you the one or do we look for another? And he tells us like this, that very hour, Jesus performed many miracles. At that very hour, there before these two people who had come from John to inquire of Jesus, suddenly Jesus manifests something of his power in healing a great number of people, and he tells us the blind saw. But it does tell us that Jesus says to them to go back and to tell John, you know, the blind see, the deaf hear. You know, what is he saying? He was telling John, wasn't he? Look, here I am, the fulfillment of these promises. Here I am, the one who has come, the restorer, to those who were sick and ill, to those who were deaf and blind, to those who were lame, to those who were dumb. I have the power to restore them. It is almost as if they were to ask a sign of Jesus, Jesus could have said to them, look, you heard of the signs. They're multiple in nature. You heard of the miracles that I'm performing. But the thing about it is, what's amazing about this is, you see, that the interesting thing is that there's this wonderful overlap between the old creation and the new creation. That in the life of Jesus, what you find is that Jesus was manifesting a time to come when all sick shall be healed, when all dead shall be raised, when all blind shall see and all the deaf shall hear. Jesus was saying, look, here I am. Here is the evidence. Here is the proof. Here are the signs, the wonders that I was expected to perform. I am coming with judgment. Yes, I am coming with deliverance and with salvation. All of these things. I'm making this tremendous declaration of who I am. The fact that I am David's greatest son. The fact that who I am. And there is this overlapping from the old to the new. You see, when Paul was writing to the church in Corinth, isn't it? Do you remember what he says to them in chapter 5, in 2 Corinthians, that is chapter 5, verse 20. He says like this, that if any man be in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things pass away, behold, all things become new. In other words, this new creation that is envisaged here has already begun. It hasn't reached its culmination, it hasn't reached its fulfillment, but it certainly has begun. And Jesus is saying in the performance of these miracles, look, it's begun. Here I am. I'm reversing the effects of the fall. I'm reversing it in the disease, the death that has come into this world. Here I am manifesting the fact of who I am by what I'm doing. And we, as we are living in this age of corruption, the age where the man has fallen and is alienated from God, yet we ourselves are part and parcel of God's new creation. That new creation has already begun in us. We are already born of the Spirit of God. We already have spiritual life in us. We are all living in anticipation of the resurrection when we will have a new body. We are living like that. And here is Isaiah saying, look, this is what's going to happen. The thirsty ground, springs of water shall come forth. The grass shall become reeds and rushes. In other words, as a developer, of course, when you look at land, if you see reeds and rushes, you can be assured there's plenty of water there. Okay? And it's not always a good sign for me, but it's a very good sign here, which was a symbol of life for these particular people. But it was that. What an encouragement. What an assurance for them, you know, that these things has already begun. We can see it. We can live in anticipation as we look back to the miracles of Jesus, as we understand what he has done in us. We can live in anticipation that the culmination of that new creation and that paradise regained is on its way. It's already begun. It's already started. We are just living now, aren't we? As those that we will see in verses 8 to 10. We are those who are looking to arrive in that paradise of God. And the whole point is this, that when we are described in the New Testament, how are we described? It tells us like this, isn't it, that we are, or as the Apostle Peter described us at any rate, we are pilgrims and sojourners in this world. In other words, we are those who are on a journey and we don't belong here. We are feeling as we are in exile from this new creation. When Paul describes the situation in Romans chapter 8, he speaks about us groaning and the whole of creation groaning. We're all waiting for that time, for the deliverance, that we might experience that resurrection morn. We're waiting for that final and ultimate deliverance of our body from corruption, from sin, disease, and illnesses, and all the frailty that is associated with this life and with this body. We're waiting for that day to come when we're going to have a body like Jesus. But we're also living in anticipation that we're going to live in God's new creation, new heavens, new earth, wherein dwells righteousness. This place is the place for God's people. This is where we're going to be housed for eternity. But see the certainty of us arriving there in verses 8 through to 10. And a highway shall be there, and it shall be called the Way of Holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk on the way. Even if they are fools or ignorant, they shall not go astray. In other words, the highway is so clear for us, so certain, that even if we were fools, we couldn't go astray. We couldn't wander off the path. It's almost as if the path is so clear to us, and the way is so clear to us, that we cannot drift to the left or to the right and get ourselves lost. It's an impossibility. The highway is an elevated place. In the deserts in those days, all they would have had would be in trails. They would have been just hardened ground. But this is like an elevated road. Couldn't be missed. It was there so evident and clear for them that they would be going along that way. There wouldn't be the unclean. There wouldn't be those who would lead us astray or seek to, as it were, undermine us or undermine our confidence. There aren't ravenous animals there. There are no lions there. There are no animals. There's nothing that's going to hinder us in getting there. There's nothing that's going to be violently opposed to us to stop us from arriving there. The certainty of getting there is assurance. This is something that is certain for us. We cannot go astray, he says. There's a place we go to in one of the Canary Islands called Fuerteventura. And if you come off the plane and you turn right as you come out of the airport and you travel up to the north, and you're going up to a town up in the top of the island, one of the roads there, in actual fact, goes through the dunes that are in Fuerteventura. And if it's a particularly windy area, and it's always windy in the Canary Islands, I can assure you, but sometimes when you drive up there, there is so much sand blown onto the road, you can barely see the road. It can be so deceiving. And it's almost as if sometimes it looks as if it's part and parcel of the sand dunes themselves. Deceived. And you can be deceived. But the wonderful thing about this path is, and this road is, that we cannot be deceived. Jesus has come along, isn't it? And he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes unto the Father but by me. You know, the certainty, we know the way. Remember when Jesus was speaking in the Sermon on the Mount? And he says like this, you know, there is a broad way that leads to destruction, but there is a narrow way, he says, that leads to life. And few there be that find it. Now, we are on that narrow way. We are on that path that leads to life. We are on this highway of holiness. We're in that place and in that secure situation that we are moving, always moving towards that place of glory. And the wonderful thing is, isn't it, that we will get there. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed, he says, shall walk there. In other words, our pilgrimage is going on at this moment of time, and we're journeying onward and forward. But in verse 10, we come to that glorious verse, don't we? And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. What a declaration for those who were God's people. The ransomed of the Lord shall return. They'll come to Zion with singing. These verses, this verse rather, when I pick up my old Bible, because I'm reading out of off my Kindle at the moment. But in Isaiah 51, it says like this about this situation. And it says, for the Lord, this is Isaiah 51 and verse 3, for the Lord will comfort Zion. He will comfort all our waste places. He will make her wilderness like Eden and his desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in it, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. And then if you go up to verses 10 and 11, it sounds like this because he's going to quote this verse. Are you not the one who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, that made the depths of the sea a road for the redeemed to cross over? Remember God bringing his people over through the Jordan. He also had brought them through the Red Sea. He had dried up this. He had made a road through it. So the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, with everlasting joy on their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, sorrow and sighing shall flee away. That's where we're heading towards, isn't it? That's where we're going to get to. Our arrival there will be with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. Singing is always symbolic, isn't it, of jubilation, joy, wonderful anticipation. We will ever be singing. We're singing now. We sing the praise of him who loved us, don't we? We sing of Christ. We sing of God. We sing of the wonderful things that he has done for us. We sing of redemption and of salvation. But when we get there, that singing won't end, but we will be singing through eternity. We will ever be singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy. Sorrow and sighing shall flee away. How often do you read in the book of Revelation, God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes? What's their state and what's their condition? The redeemed of the Lord, as you can read about them, then in Revelation 5 and in Revelation 7, it tells us in Revelation 5, they sang a new song. Worthy is the Lamb that was slain. Worthy, why? For you have redeemed us unto God by your blood. In other words, we are ever praising and glorifying and magnifying the Christ of God. He is the Lamb slain. His blood has availed for us. His blood purchased us. We are the ransomed of the Lord. We are those he paid the price for us. He has redeemed us from our sin. He has redeemed creation itself from the curse. Judgment has fallen, but here everything has been turned and reversed. Where there was sorrow and sadness, there shall be joy and rejoicing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. What a wonderful thing, isn't it? For us to be reminded, as we were on Sunday, what it is to be a Christian. The multitudes of blessings that are ours in Christ. And yet here, when we come to that glorious place, we shall enter the courts of God with praises upon our lips, with thanks within our heart and with worship in our spirit. All of these things have been given to us in Christ. We are the ransomed. What is the purpose of the journey? The purpose of every journey is to arrive at our destination. Terrible, isn't it? To be traveling and traveling and traveling all the time, but never arriving. What on earth is the point of traveling? The whole point of traveling is to get to the destination. It's the destination we want, not the traveling. But when we get there, oh, what a joy. Jubilant. We shall be singing, praising him forever.